A feature in Madison Magazine a few years ago begins, "Maybe Jennifer Mnookin had never waded in a cranberry bog, held a piglet at a state fair, or eaten cheese curds before she became chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, but she's figuring out the Wisconsin idea in her first year holding the top job on campus." I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. Today, my guest is UW-Madison Chancellor Jennifer Mnookin, now more than 3 years into the job. So much has happened in those years, from protests on campus to cuts in federal funding to advances in AI. I'm calling this show, which marks my last broadcast for University of the Year after 30 years of doing shows, Meet UW-Madison Chancellor Jennifer Mnookin. Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you so much, Emily.
I met you in your second day of the job. You came out to South Madison, where I do the UW Odyssey Project, to meet our non-traditional low-income students who are doing a jumpstart course from the university. And I was impressed then with how you embrace the community. I also was impressed at your investiture with the way that you paid tribute to your father, who was there leading a procession representing Harvard, I think.
True enough.
Yeah. And I think before we get to some of the challenges you've been facing and are facing now, and some of the joys of being chancellor, can you talk about your own background? I'm sure you didn't grow up saying as a kid, I'm going to grow up to be chancellor of UW.
Goodness, no. Yes. Or even that I would be a chancellor of anything, or even necessarily a professor or anything like that. I also would love to go back to that second day where I got to come to the Odyssey Project and see some of the amazing work that you do and the way that that kind of opportunity can transform people's lives. Because for me, that's honestly at the heart of what a school like ours does and is. It's about opportunity. So I hope we can get a chance to come back to that.
Sure.
But yes, so it's true that when I got here, I hadn't done any of those things like wade in a cranberry bog or hold a piglet. I have now. I've gotten to do
both of
those and many, many more things here in the amazing state of Wisconsin in my role. But I did grow up in an academic family. My father is a professor. He's, in fact, a law professor. And I also became a law professor. I didn't grow up always knowing that I wanted to be a law professor or professor at all. I did grow up at a dining room table where there was a lot of discussion and sometimes argument, and I had to learn to kind of hold my own. And I did go off to college having lived in relatively academic spaces. And so I felt a strong sense of belonging on college campuses. And one of the things that I was really aware of, even as an undergraduate, is that not everyone there arrived with that same sense that this was a place for them. And so for all of the complexity in higher education and all of the challenges, one of the areas that is important to me personally is to ask the question, how can we help everyone on our campus have some sense that this is a place for them? Because that was not, I mean, of course, there were moments when I felt imposter syndrome or didn't feel a sense of belonging.
Weren't you at Harvard, Yale, and MIT?
I did attend all three of those.
Those are pretty highfalutin campuses.
Sure, but I guess the point for me is that all of us, no matter our backgrounds, our identities, or our beliefs, we have moments where we feel uncomfortable. But we also, I hope, have moments where we can think, wow, this is a place that I belong, where I can contribute, where I can learn, where I can connect. And part of what I want for us at UW-Madison is to be that, no matter whether you're, you know, a Democrat or a Republican, no matter your identity, no matter your major, no matter whether you're studying, you know, nuclear engineering or dance. And on a campus as big as ours, that can be hard to do, but it's so important.
I think I read somewhere that you donated a kidney to your father. Is that correct?
I did. It's true.
Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, so he was 78 when it became clear that he was going to need a transplant if he had any hope of not going on dialysis and, frankly, any hope of surviving for a considerable period of time. He was at an age where if he'd gone onto the donor waiting list, he would not have ended up with an organ. Where he was, you aged off of the list at 80, and the list was at least a 5-year waiting period. And so unless he found a donor, he would end up on dialysis and at significantly more medical risk. And in my immediate family, I turned out to be the only possibility. And it was, I will be honest, it wasn't like an, if this had been my children, it would have been a snap decision. Of course I'll do this. But to do it contragenerationally isn't as much of a snap decision. But as I thought about it, I realized that this was, if I were healthy enough, this was a gift I could give to him and hopefully extend his life and his quality of life at really very low risk to myself. And so I made the decision that if it turned out I got through a whole battery of tests, and there were, you know, a zillion of them, that I was game to do this. And I was fortunate enough to be healthy enough to move forward. It was during COVID, Emily, and I was in Los Angeles, and my father was in Massachusetts. And Mass General wanted me to come there and quarantine for 2 weeks and then do the surgery. And then I'd have to stick around for 3 or 4 weeks afterwards, which either would have been a really long time to be away from my own family, or they would have to come too. And so instead, we were able to arrange it so that I donated in California, and my kidney went on a United Airlines red eye with a geotag, I'm happy to say. I was a little worried about what if my kidney gets lost. And then it was implanted in him the next morning. And the reason why that's possible is a buffering solution. And you know what? It's called the University of Wisconsin solution because it was invented right here. So this was before I was a candidate, before, I mean, I knew a lot about UW as just an amazing, high-quality institution, but the University of Wisconsin changed my family's life by making that possible.
That is wonderful, and I will share a few family connections of my own to UW because my husband, a professor of medicine, directed the lung transplant program here, but was aware of that buffering solution and sometimes would go on the flights to get the organs to bring them quickly to help save patients, and the UW hospital has an amazing record with transplants.
An amazing record. That's just one of so many. But it is an amazing strength space here. We are we have a really quite incredible transplant program. We're also a transplant program that does better and works harder than many to think about living donors and their experiences, because that isn't true everywhere. And so I'm very proud that that's one of our strengths. And it's also incredibly exciting. I mean, there's a clinical study that we're doing right now that may give transplant recipients the possibility of not being on immunosuppressants for life by using, you know, stem cells and being able to make it so that their own body won't reject the organ. If that works, that will be huge and life-changing for many recipients. So it's super exciting to see the strengths in research in that area here. And of course, that's just one of so many
different
areas.
Things. Right. And I like the kind of lifelong, you know, badger for life, lifelong learning aspect of things too. I know, you know, my children have done college for kids programs or summer music clinic. I went to UW on a music clinic scholarship.
Excellent.
That paid for that. My father came here as a professor of zoology in 1957 when the salary was $5,000 a year, so he immediately got music jobs to help support the family. Mother was a medical reference librarian here. You know, just my son went through UW-Madison on a Viola scholarship and went on to Juilliard. You know, the lots of connections with the university. And what I find when I meet people is, you know, they'll say, oh, yeah, my cousin did this, or, you know, I use this program at the university, or I'm getting to audit a class as a senior auditor, that there's this feeling that whether you're a child or an elder, there's something at the university that you can find that's
Absolutely.
For you.
No, it's really quite amazing. I mean, obviously, our degree-granting programs are a huge part of what we do, but we also touch so many young people and many adults who aren't in degree programs. And I think about half the people in my neighborhood are auditing some course at the university in any given semester. And I love that we can offer that collection of opportunities for people across their lives. I mean, I think I know we're not here to talk about the Amazing Odyssey program, which you run, but it is inspiring how it's both an opportunity for a set of people who may not have had access to higher education or believed that it was for them, right? Who didn't have the experiences that led them to think that this was something they could do. And for a collection of the people in your program, it's a launch pad to actually then going and getting degrees. I mean, that's transformative.
Yeah, we have, thank you for those words. We have students who were homeless, who were told, you're not college material, by a high school guidance counselor.
I remember one who wrote a poem about that.
Yes, she did. She was in this On Wisconsin feature, Shar Braxton. She just got back from China. She was the first Odyssey student to do the study abroad program this summer and is working on her bachelor's in Chinese and creative writing. She wrote a poem where part of it's in Chinese, and she's inviting that high school guidance counselor to journey with her to China.
How amazing is that?
We have another student who's in his last year of law school here, another applying to medical school. One just got his doctorate in dentistry elsewhere, but started at UW, and nurses and others who are coming through the program. And I think one reason Odyssey is so dear to me is because my parents both came out of poverty through Berea College. Berea College in Kentucky, it's the only school in the country where you have to be poor to go there. I didn't know that growing up. I thought there must be lots of Bereas, you know, where it's designed for Appalachian youth like my mother, who had no running water and no one had gone to college, and my father, who was a Holocaust survivor, refugee story of poverty. Berea gave all of them free tuition, you know, and It's an amazing place. I have seen some of the new programs that you've been involved with, the Pell Grant, Bucky's Promise,
You're
and some
exactly
of the
right.
other things.
I mean,
can you talk about what you see the University of Wisconsin-Madison doing that will make more first-generation students, more students who think, gosh, I can't go to college, I can't afford it?
So we won't have official numbers until day 10 of the semester, and it just started. Yesterday was, I know this won't be airing for a bit, but yesterday, as I sit recording with you, was just our first day of classes. But probably by the time this airs, we'll know these numbers, and I expect that we will have more, both in number and percentage, of Pell Grant students in this entering freshman class than we've ever had. So I'm really happy about that. I mean, that's, you know, Pell Grants are obviously not the only indicator, but they're a strong indicator of students who are in families who are of limited income, and we're able to now support those students. Becky Blank, my predecessor, created a program called Bucky's Tuition Promise, which basically said to the people of Wisconsin that if your family earns about the Wisconsin median income or less, you will not pay tuition here. And I think that's an amazing program. And I was able in my first year to build on that further with something called Bucky's Pell Pathway, which means that if you get a Pell Grant, and these are very overlapping groups, they're not identical, but they're overlapping. If you're receiving a Pell Grant as a Wisconsin student, we will, on top of the rest of whatever scholarships you might be getting, we will meet your full cost of attendance, not just tuition, but room and board and your expected living expenses. We'll even try to make it possible for you to, you know, go on an abroad program if you want. And it's a pathway to graduating debt-free. It's not necessarily a promise to graduate debt-free because, you know, people's circumstances can vary and they may choose to send some money home and choose to borrow a little bit. So it's not a promise, but it's a real pathway. And I'm really pleased that about two-thirds of our most recent graduating class at the undergraduate level graduated with zero debt.
That seems unusual these days to graduate from a four-year
institution. And, you know, most of our undergraduates who are graduating with debt, they're not the kind of ballooning giant numbers that you sometimes hear about in the news. And so, you know, this is one of the places, it's one of the many places right now where there's sometimes a disconnect between some of the narratives about higher education and then our on-the-ground experience, right? Because, I mean, sometimes when I talk to people about Bucky's Pell Pathway and Bucky's Tuition Promise, and sometimes in polls that we do too, some folks in Wisconsin, they don't believe us. They're like, no, you're not really doing that. I'm here to say, yes, we are. If you're getting a Pell Grant, we will help you have a pathway to covering the full cost of your attendance here at UW-Madison.
But that's only if you're accepted. And it is true that you're turning away a record number of highly qualified applicants who want to go here, right?
Well, we are a selective institution. And you're right that some of the people we say no to could have succeeded here. We're not in the place where we can take everybody who we think could be successful here. We are able to admit typically a little over half of our in-state applicants. And so we aren't in the business. Some schools out there may try to talk a lot of people into applying just to like have bigger numbers, and they want to say no to more. Mm-hmm. That's not our goal.
No.
That is not what we're trying to do. But it's true that we're not in a position either for our in-state applicants or our out-of-state applicants, and it is a little bit more selective to get into our institution from out-of-state. That's harder. We are having to say no to qualified students who might be able to succeed in this experience.
For some, the pathway is as a transfer student, right?
Absolutely. Many students transfer. In fact, we've got about 1,200 joining this year's entering class as sophomores or juniors, and they transfer from all kinds of institutions. Some come from two-year colleges, or whether it's here in Wisconsin, whether it's technical schools or part of the UW two-year system. Some of them come from our UW sister schools. Some of them come from private institutions. Some of them come from out of state. And so that is another pathway to have access to our undergraduate degree. And it's an important one for us.
For the traditional undergraduates that come here, some who come from small towns in Wisconsin or elsewhere, it's a real culture shock, I think. I remember when I taught a large freshman literature class. It was about 400 students in a giant classroom, you know, with teaching assistants working with me. And I had one student who came to me after class. She had missed the class and was crying because she walked into the lecture hall, saw 400 students, and she said there were more people in my class than she had in her old home, the whole town. I can't remember if it was Balsam Lake or Oconda Falls, one of those towns that had 315 people at that time.
That could be a little overwhelming.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So I told her to sit in the front row and look at me, and we would get through it, and she did. But I think going off to college, you know, at 18, coming to Madison in this giant university filled with opportunities, it has to be so overwhelming for many students. What are some of the things you do? You know, you mentioned this is the early days of this semester. What do you do to make a freshman like that feel at home?
Absolutely. It's a great question. And it's actually a question that goes back to sort of wanting to have every student feel some sense that this is a place for them. And absolutely, it could be overwhelming and a little scary to come from a small town or even just a small high school in a bigger place to a university as large as we are. I think we aim to do a whole lot of things to help. And for many students, I think those work really well. But I'm not going to look at you and say that this can't be a period of adjustment and challenge for some students. Nearly all of our students find their way through that. So Wisconsin Welcome, we have this literally hundreds of events over the first month of school that are actually designed for exactly this purpose, right? So the vast, vast majority of our freshmen do live in dorms. They don't have to, but we do encourage it. There's actually data showing that living in a dorm your first year is associated with a greater sense of connection and a little bit higher on average academic success. Mm-hmm. So we urge it, but we don't require it. The dorms have a whole set of activities and, you know, house fellows that are trained to help with helping students feel connected. There's big things you can go to and small things you can go to and lots of things you can go to. There's an app for it even. It can help you find things to connect with. Last year, our student affairs team created a set of events that were specifically designed to encourage students to feel really comfortable coming alone, because it can be scary to
sure.
walk into something you're interested in, but not have someone to join with you in that. And actually at Convocation this year, our wonderful student speaker told a story about her own experience. And she's from a low-income family, and her parents are immigrants. And she decided, because someone urged her to check out the union director at Film Club early in her time here, and she thought, like, why is she even doing this? She's not that into film. She doesn't know that much about, you know, film theory, and there's lots and lots and lots of movies she'd never seen. But she nonetheless ended up finding this as one of the places that she built community. And so we do try to help encourage our students to jump into a few things and see what sticks for them, and also to have a kind of cornucopia of possibilities. But I grant that I think there's for students from small communities, and maybe especially for first-gen students from small communities, there's bravery in saying, you know what? I'm going to come to this big city-like school, and I want to, in my role as chancellor, I want to honor that bravery. I want to sort of say, hey, good for you, and also to try to help our students navigate that. One thing we're starting this year, which I'm excited about, is we've had some activities specifically focused on first-gen and low-income students, but we're actually creating an office to give that more structure and more infrastructure, and to also try to listen to students from these communities to ask, what do you need in order to make your transition to UW and your time here more opportunity-generating to help you reach your full potential?
That's great. I know I had an Odyssey student, first generation, who said college to him seemed like a chess game, that nobody had told him the rules, what the bishop did and the rook. It looked like a great game that everybody else was playing and knew what to do. And I think to create some special services for first generation students is terrific.
The other thing is to realize that nobody actually feels completely comfortable in those first days. I mean, again, you know,
including the faculty who 100%. Have to teach the classes too. I'm always nervous before a first class. We're going to talk more with Chancellor Jennifer Mnookin when we continue in a moment on University of the Year. Whatever may be the limitations which trammel inquiry elsewhere, we believe that the great state University of Wisconsin should ever encourage that continual and fearless sifting and winnowing by which alone the truth can be found. That's a quote that is now on a plaque on Bascom Hill at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Chancellor Jennifer Mnookin, and we are talking about her role as UW Chancellor. Can you tell me what that quote means to you?
Yes, I love that quote, and we love that quote. I mean, that is, when I think about what's core UW-Madison, I think that the Wisconsin idea and sifting and winnowing would both be pretty near the top of the list. I love that we use an agricultural metaphor that has, you know, a century-long history to talk about the importance of getting a lot of different ideas out there on the table to try to figure out which ones are worth pursuing, and how we can best achieve truth, and how we can learn from one another. So to me, it stands for both the need for different ideas to come into connection and sometimes into tension with one another, and to be doing that for the purpose of learning, but also for the purpose of trying to make a difference in the world.
I understand it came from a report by the Board of Regents in 1894, when there were accusations against the head of UW's School of Economics for teaching, you know, utopian, impractical, and pernicious doctrine. So it came as a kind of statement of academic freedom.
Exactly. No, it's a core statement about the importance of academic freedom, even when the ideas that the faculty member might be pursuing are not in fashion at that moment, or even when there's actually very strong counterarguments. I mean, the speaker who was the professor who was being defended there had views both that may be more commonplace now and some that we would really reject, most of us, in current times. But the idea of academic freedom and the idea that we want to protect our faculty's and our students' ability to pursue to take their curiosity where it goes, but also that we expect them to think about ideas and counter ideas, I think, goes to the heart of the university.
Academic freedom and sort of freedom of speech, they seem pretty tricky in some ways because one person's right to express an extreme viewpoint, you know, that freedom that they have that view, when does that become then harassment or hate speech or something that we really can't tolerate because it is injurious to another person or group?
Yeah, no, this is a wildly important question, and it's one that is difficult around the edges. You know, so we're a public institution, and one of the things that means is that the First Amendment of the Constitution, which protects freedom of speech, it's really a protection against government incursion into people's freedom. And we're considered the government for this purpose. So we, unlike private institutions, for us as a public school, the First Amendment applies directly. It's not a choice. And the First Amendment protects a huge amount of speech. It even protects a lot of speech that many people would find offensive or even hateful. The First Amendment and our jurisprudence makes the choice that we would rather have broader protections of speech than have the government saying what's okay and what isn't okay, unless it really crosses a line into being like a threat to your physical safety, a true threat, or discrimination or harassment. And so one of the things that means is that on our campus, when somebody says something that another person finds distressing, even hateful, it's probably still protected speech under the First Amendment. If they really make a threat to your physical safety, that is not protected.
Right. You know, yelling fire in the theater kind
of
thing.
That's right. But if they utter an opinion or even use an epithet or otherwise say things that we might nearly all say really aren't okay, it may well still be protected speech. And so this is a tough space because often in those moments, people don't want to hear that it's that was permitted. And there's a big space between what's lawful and what's the right thing to do. So, I mean, I hope we can create a community where people do think hard about the impact of their words. But we also must have a community where people know that the First Amendment will be respected and that there won't be punishment by the university for speech, even when it's unwelcome to some or many.
I bet
it's a hard line.
It is.
It's a really hard line.
I bet your background in law probably helps out just a little bit to have to think about what's legal as opposed to what's something you feel good about.
Yeah, it's kind of a different. I think it probably does help. I'm not a First Amendment expert. This isn't my area. I'm an evidence scholar. But I was also dean of a law school where it won't shock you to know these issues sometimes yeah. arose there as well. You know, we absolutely have no tolerance for discrimination or harassment or for threats to people's physical safety. But under the First Amendment, an awful lot of other speech is tolerated, even when you and I and many others might think, gosh, there was a way better way to talk about this.
I saw in an article about the convocation that was held recently that you spoke to the incoming group of freshmen about pluralism.
Mm-hmm.
Can you define what you meant by pluralism and why that's something you're passionate about?
Absolutely. So pluralism is kind of a funny word, and it doesn't roll off the tongue. But I think it captures a very important idea, which is that we learn from people who are different from us. We can also learn from people who are similar to us, right? But that it actually connects to sifting and winnowing, that if we're going to try to have to move ideas forward and to make a difference and to figure out what we believe, that works best when we have the chance to hear from and to test our ideas alongside those who see the world differently. Those differences might come from identity differences. They might come from people with different backgrounds or races or cultures. They might be just viewpoint differences or political differences. But that when we bring people with different identities, backgrounds, and viewpoints and try to create an environment where they start with curiosity rather than judgment, we can best achieve learning, and even sharpening of your own beliefs. When you talk to someone who sees the world really differently, it may not change your mind, But you may suddenly realize that there is a better argument for something that you thought was kind of silly than you previously understood. Or you might realize that one of your arguments isn't grounded in the data. Sometimes you might even change your mind, but other times you might just become, you might better understand your own point of view from that engagement. I think this is something that universities have always done. I think that we've always done it. I also think it's something that we can do with more intentionality. And, you know, there's a set of critics of the university who say that we haven't focused enough on viewpoint diversity within our walls. I don't think that that criticism is as true as some of them think it is, but I do think there's some merit to it. I think it's true that we can sometimes create our own bubbles, and we can be in spaces where many of our faculty share the same beliefs about matters that if you open the doors and let out the broader world in, there's actually much more diversity of viewpoint. And if we don't think about that broader set of viewpoints and how to engage with them within our communities, I think we're not doing our best for our students or for civil discourse or, frankly, for our shared pluralist democracy.
And you certainly learn more when people next to you don't have the same views. It's actually one of the questions I ask when I'm interviewing for the Odyssey Project, because we're turning away over 100 people for 30 spots each year. And one of the questions I ask students is, how do you feel about sitting in a classroom with someone next to you who voted for someone you can't stand, has a different religion, a different background, and they're expressing a worldview that's nothing like your own? And if the answer is, well, I'll tell them what they should think, or, you know, I'll tell them to think my way, they're not in the class. But if they say, oh, I'd love a chance to learn, if I feel that open-mindedness and that they're going to be tolerant, then that is a plus for me for being in a class where you have people who have been made to feel they don't belong, or they may be coming from, you know, we have students in the class who are from Zimbabwe, Togo, Tibet, you know, Mexico, all over the place.
All over, absolutely.
And they have to feel they're coming to a safe place. Can you talk about the international community? I lived for a while at Eagle Heights and University Houses, where it's like living in a UNICEF poster or something, with families from all different countries who are attending UW. There's been a threat to international students on campus, and just talk in general about what international students add and some of the changes there.
We've had international students as part of our community since the very beginning. 177 years ago in our very first class, there was one international student. And I think that international students enrich our community in so many ways. And I think we also end up contributing to the globe in part through our international students. I'm struck by a couple, and there have been challenges over the last period of time and over the last year that have, we did have a set of students who had their student visas at risk. We were able to navigate that. It is somewhat more challenging right now for international students to get visas. I'm pleased to say that we do still expect students from more than 50 different countries to be joining our freshman class. We expect a decline in our international students overall, both in the freshman class and at the PhD level, partly because we did somewhat reduce some of our PhD entering classes because of federal budget challenge risks. So there are multiple dynamics at play here. But our global community enriches, I mean, the entire experience for everybody, gives all of our students, again, more chances to learn from those who are different from themselves in a variety of ways, to bring different perspectives to bear. But also, our international students do amazing things as graduates. So some of them stay right here in Wisconsin. It's been interesting, some of the startups all over the state, here in Madison, but also well beyond, a number of our international students play key roles, right? It's a brave thing to decide to go abroad for university. Probably says something about your gameness to take certain kinds of risks to pursue what you're passionate about. And some of that same, you know, way of being in the world may connect to those who choose to be entrepreneurs or choose to try other things like that. I will also tell you that I had the chance as part of our 175th celebration to go to Korea and Thailand and meet a number of our international alums from those countries as well as from other Asian countries who came to some of the events that we had. I learned that at one of Korea's top three universities, they have more of their faculty with U.S. PhDs are Wisconsin graduates than any other university. So we are living the Wisconsin idea in this other way, where graduates are contributing to the further education back in their home countries or in countries that they make their homes in so many different fields. And I found that really inspiring.
So let me play devil's advocate. Let's say, how would you answer it if I said, why should I, as a Wisconsin taxpayer, be funding the University of Wisconsin-Madison if it's educating students who then go back to their country and share that knowledge and expertise with that country, possibly developing technology, weapons, and things that would be a threat?
Well, you put it pretty strongly there. I guess what I would say is this. I'd say a couple of different things. So first of all, the undergraduate level, this is part of why our in-state tuition is so much lower than our out-of-state tuition. It is because Wisconsin taxpayers and Wisconsin contribute to this institution. It's also why our acceptance rate for Wisconsin students tilts higher, right? So we want to do right by Wisconsin. And again, a number of these international graduates stay here and end up making lives here and end up becoming Wisconsinites. So I think that's a really important piece of the story. I think in terms of the ways we contribute globally, there can be different views and we should sift and winnow. We should talk about that. I believe that that higher education in the United States has been globally recognized strong product. I think that there's soft diplomacy pluses to that. I think that trying to, frankly, I'd even put it that we're sort of bringing American values to the broader world when students come here, have formative experiences, and then go back to their home countries. We do have a responsibility in the national security spaces to think about what that means. And with some countries, there are limits and regulations, and that is also potentially appropriate. I think that those are legitimate things to be concerned about. But so are the benefits of global collaboration and a global talent force. Many of the international students who come here are interested in potentially building a future in our country. And for us to be a net importer of global talent, when I think about the innovation economy and I think about creativity and I think about our collective future, I think those are big strengths. But I think those are fair questions, and we should be a place that can debate them all.
We're going to talk about some of the things you're the most proud of and that you found the most challenging when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. I shall never be content until the beneficent influence of the university reaches every family in the state. So said Charles Van Hise in 1905. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Chancellor Jennifer Mnookin, and we are talking about her role as chancellor. Give me a sense of a day in your life.
Sure. So one of the amazing parts of my job is its incredible variety. I get the chance to spend time with students, faculty, my administrative team, legislators, alums, people throughout the state, other higher education leaders. It can sometimes be vertiginous, honestly. Like sometimes you go from, you know, the chance to meet a leader of a global university, and then next you get to go see what some students are doing, and then you get to think about a thorny administrative challenge that you're wrestling with or something that's just come down at the federal level. And I sometimes tell students, I do monthly chats with the chancellor. Any student can sign up. We pick by lottery among those who want to participate. And I sometimes tell them that I'm more mayor than CEO. We are a very decentralized organization, and I get to help lead our direction. But we are also so big and complicated that 1,000 things are happening on any day here that I have no idea about. And that when I want to try to bring about more awareness or even change, there's some things where they are in my authority. I'm not trying to say that I have no decision-making power, but oftentimes that's about bringing people along to help bring awareness to a set of issues rather than just snapping my fingers and making it so. So I love that variety. I'm
even
extrovert.
The football games and the ice cream.
Absolutely. I get to have an ice cream flavor named for me. Like, how cool is that? I get to go to an array of athletic events. I get to spend time throughout the state. I've had a lot of fun learning about all of the things that happen across the state. I meet with legislators sometimes in their home districts. I meet with local officials. I've met with farmers who get great benefit from some of the work they do from our agricultural research stations. I meet with industry throughout Wisconsin, places ranging from Titletown Tech that's doing amazing startup work out of Green Bay to small enterprises. I mean, I was at a meat processing facility, a relatively small one, where the owner told me that he would not be in business but for the training and opportunities that he was able to have together with CALS and Extension. That was what let him build this, you know, this business of his to much larger enterprises that are collaborating with us in research or are built out of research that began here at the university. It's really an incredible array of opportunities, and also sometimes the need to move rapidly from one frame of mind to another. It's a hard job, it's a demanding job, but it's also frankly a gift to have this opportunity to help lead this incredible institution during what are not the easiest times.
Absolutely.
For higher education.
And how do you think we're doing on what President Van Hise said in 1905 about having the university reach every family in the state?
Well, at a literal level, I don't think we're reaching every family in the state, but I think we do a lot of good in the state and beyond. We talk about that.
Do you think sometimes people don't know that something that they use every day, like, for example, my father's on Warfarin after,
right,
which is named
for Wharf.
Wharf,
exactly.
A building right here in Madison at the university, or something with vitamin D or with transplants or other things. Are there ways that you think people actually are benefiting from the UW without even knowing it?
Oh, hugely. I mean, so everything, you've given a few scientific examples. You know, we actually run through Extension 4-H. I think lots of people have no idea about that. I think that, again, in the ag space, there's ways that we're helping potato farmers and cranberry growers and dairy farms. And some of those collaborating with us understand that very well and really appreciate the collaboration. But in broader communities, I think that's often not known and not understood.
And we have Wisconsin Public Radio, Wisconsin Public Television, and there are also ways that people meet university faculty or hear them talking about something, call in to shows to give their opinions as well.
Absolutely.
I was doing a call-in show once where in the background I could hear cows mooing. I was talking about the Bronte sisters and novels, and there was mooing in the background. And I thought, this is the Wisconsin idea, where wherever you are and whatever you're doing, you can be part of a discussion.
Yeah, I mean, the way that Van Hise talked about it, about bringing the beneficence from UW-Madison, that's not the way we talk about it now.
No, it's two-way.
It's two-way. It's absolutely bidirectional. We do not have all the answers, and we need to understand what communities are looking for from us and with us. But even, you know, the Follett School last year did a Main Street project where they went into several different communities and brought people together for conversations about areas that they cared about across their differences. And people left those meetings having a somewhat more positive view of those on the other side of the aisle than what they walked in with. How cool is that, right? That's just one example among so many. A few that really excite me, I mean, so theranostics, which comes from the word for therapeutics and diagnostics, and is a new way of thinking about some kinds of cancer treatment, where we're much more targeted, using very targeted drugs and radioisotopes to try to get rid of cancer without causing as much harm as systemic agents like chemotherapy do. I mean, that is wildly exciting. We are a leader in Alzheimer's research. We had the first dance department in the country. We are doing amazing social science research about poverty and, you know, what are sort of possible ways of helping to alleviate it. So there are so many ways that our work is connecting to the world. And it's also kind of in the DNA of the institution. I mean, one of the things that's been incredibly thrilling for me in my role is to see how many of the people connected to us care about trying to make a difference through their work. They want to do excellent research. They want to be good teachers, but they also want to try to make a difference in the broader world. Maybe that's through curiosity-driven research. I mean, you know, if we better understand the origins of life on Earth or life elsewhere, that may not have, like, commercial impact tomorrow, but it may help us understand at an even deeper level what it means to be human. And so there's all of these ways that we can broaden how people experience opportunity and connection in the broader world, and that's what we want to try to do.
And with the arts and humanities, you know, creating these works that so they live long after the composer or the artist or the writer is
absolutely
gone.
Absolutely. That's exactly right.
So tell me, what are some of the lowest moments you've hit as a chancellor? These have been really tough times in terms of federal things and in terms of, you know, just challenges. It seems as if there's breaking news, not just once a day, but several times a day.
You're absolutely right. There's a lot of challenge out there. And there is also not a huge amount of trust in higher education writ large right now. That's part of a broader phenomenon where there's not a lot of trust in institutions, period. So there's actually more trust in higher ed than there is in, say, Congress. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, when you look over the last decade or so, there's been a reduction in trust shown in many, many polls. Depending on your political identification, you're even more likely to have more distrust in us if you do identify as a Republican, but we've seen distrust grow across all party lines. And that's dispiriting, and it's something we can't ignore. We can't just say it's because they don't understand us well enough. We can't just say it may be partly about how we tell our stories and how we think about engaging in the broader world, but I think it is more than that. I think we have to look in the mirror and ask, what are the value propositions here? How can we make sure that we're living the Wisconsin idea? One of my lowest days was the day that the legislature decided not to support the engineering building, which had been something that the university had attempted to move forward with through several budget cycles. And it partly stemmed from, I think, a continued lack of trust between parts of the legislature and our campus. And I'm really pleased that we were able to find our way past that. And now we've broken ground on mm-hmm. that particular building. But to try to figure out ways to build bridges and create connections so that all of Wisconsin can be proud of this institution. They don't have to like every single thing we do. We're cacophonous. There's so many parts of who we are and what we do. I'm proud that when we do polling here in the state of Wisconsin, the vast, vast majority of Wisconsinites, when asked at the end of the day, is the UW-Madison good for our state? The answer is yes. Like something like over 90% say mm-hmm. yes. And I think we should feel really good about that. But I would like us to get to the place where ordinary Wisconsinites who might not have attended and might not have an immediate family member who attended, nonetheless do see that in some of the medical breakthroughs that might impact their family, in the fact that they might have a physician in rural Wisconsin who got training from here, mm-hmm. or who, if they didn't, might be able to use telemedicine or right. opportunities to learn from somebody here, that we are touching their lives and hopefully expanding their opportunities. I do think there's more work we can do in that space, but I am also proud of the many ways that we do connect to people throughout the state already.
And if you could imagine, you know, you're coming into your fourth year now, right?
I am.
Okay. So if you can imagine 3 years from now, another 3 years under your belt, what will look like success for you? What are you hoping to be able to share at that point?
I love that question. Thank you. I hope that we will see even more of a turnaround around trust in the university. We are seeing in polling numbers this past year a little bit of a shift in the other direction. I would love to see that grow. I hope that on our campus, we are having student communities who feel connected and feel a sense of belonging, whatever their backgrounds, whether they're from the tiniest town in rural Wisconsin or whether they're coming to us from Milwaukee or from across the globe. I'd like to hope that our graduates are having opportunities in the workforce that are giving them both a first job, but that they're also ready for pivoting and thinking that they're leaving us with the skills that will help them achieve both a living and a flourishing life. And I'd hope that our research successes from our STEM fields to our spaces of arts and humanities continue to flourish and blossom. We're really proud that we have a huge amount of research funded. In fact, this past year, we were sixth in the country for that. And that's a great number and a pride point. But actually, deep down, I think I care more about impact than just the size of that number. How can we show our impact and the ways that we're making a difference? I'd like to think that in the entrepreneurship space and in the partnership space, whether that's community partnerships, industry partnerships, government partnerships, that we would see some expanded strength as well. So none of this is revolutionary. We're an institution that I think is doing a lot right, but I'd like to see us be able to lean in to opportunity creation, both for those who are immediate parts of our community, but also for our state as a whole.
But you won't be replaced by AI.
I hope not. So AI has, you know, obviously is much more part of the conversation now. It's the potential of AI is tremendous. The risks are also real. It is changing for a number of faculty the way they're teaching. And there is both opportunity and risk. Our students have to leave here AI literate. Many are arriving more sophisticated about the use of large language models than some of their faculty. And there are dangers. Some of the kinds of ways that we would assess students are things that AI is pretty good at. And so we have to change there. There's a lot of different ways to change. Some classes are incorporating AI as an explicit tool. Other classes are going old school, blue books, and ways of requiring students to write in ways that can't be offloaded to technology. I think there's really amazing opportunities here. I will tell you that AI is pretty good at writing a mid-level memo to an administrator about why to give more funding to thing X or Y. But we still need critical thinking, and we still need people who can synthesize and bring ideas together for the best possible futures.
So we need to keep sifting and winnowing.
Bingo, you said it beautifully.
Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, Chancellor. Thank you so much for the chance to talk to you, and thank you for the work that you've done at this institution.
I'm Emily Auerbach, and I'm signing off. This is my last broadcast for University of the Year.